everybody, and welcome back to another Pink Bike Podcast. I'm Mike Levy, and I swear that there's no Formula One in this podcast. I promise. But what there is we're going to talk about some things that the industry could do better. And this all comes from an article that Mr. Seb Stott wrote titled, Five Things That the Bike Industry Could Do Better, which is pretty self-explanatory. Judging by the comment section under that article, though, there were about 5,000 things that the bike industry could possibly do better. So today, I've got Brian and Casimir with me because we're going to talk about all of that stuff. But first, I wanted to be, you know, I'm a positive guy. You guys know this, right? Kaz, you know I'm a positive guy, right?
Yeah, all rainbows and sunshine all the time.
Exactly. So that's how I want to start this podcast. And Brian, I'm going to ask you, what is something that the industry does really well?
should I make everybody upset right off the bat?
Yes, 100%.
Okay. Well, the top comment on Seb's article was that bikes are not affordable. And that's the biggest problem with the industry. And we are all going to get roasted in this podcast when we don't say that bikes are too expensive. And obviously we come from a privileged place as media in the bike industry, but honestly, I don't totally agree with consumer sentiment here. Like, I think the bike industry has dramatically improved the bike over the past 10 years, even for the money. Like, you get a much better, more capable bike for the same percentage of your paycheck in 2023 than you could in 2013. Like, yes, the most expensive bikes have gotten way more expensive, the ones we spend a lot of time talking about, and that, like, they've gotten absurdly expensive, and I'm not a huge fan of that. But honestly, for the bikes that most people buy, your money goes further today, which is impressive.
So I've been working on an op-ed basically titled Mountain Biking Isn't Too Expensive. Casimir has told me not to write it about 10 times. Rightfully so, but I do sort of agree. And I also understand people's sentiment that we are idiots with that opinion. But also, like, bikes are, some of them are a lot more expensive. But I think we're going to talk about this because this is on my list too. I think a lot of it is perception. Like, we test really expensive bikes a lot of the times. But there are so many, like, $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 bikes and way less than that too. So, like, if you want to go mountain biking, you don't need a $3,000 anything to do it. So
we're also a little bit, we're all old and have been mountain biking for a long time, and we're scarred from the years of having to ride with a square tape or bottom bracket in your backpack because it was for sure going to break. So I think we appreciate where bikes are at right now in a way that if you started in 2010 and the most expensive bike was $8,000 and now the most expensive bike is $16,000, that's offensive. And to be fair, like, I do think the high end is maybe too high right now. And that's a fair thing. And, like, it's a bit frustrating. Maybe just that's my secret communism showing, but we should have Henry here right now. But no, honestly, I think that if we're going to give props to the industry for one thing, like, I have to say the middle of the road bike is pretty damn good right now. And they've done well to keep their foot on the gas since 2013. Because in 2013, I thought we were done. I genuinely did. I thought, man, how much better can bikes get?
That's like that old, I don't know if it's true or not, but I've read that thing where, like, the guy wanted to close down the patent office in, like, 1911 because, like, everything's been invented, you know? Like, we think right now they're amazing.
Totally.
Because that was also my thing, is that just bikes in general are crazy capable. Like, you can go and spend, you know, $2,500, $3,000 on a full suspension bike. And, like, Kaz, you and I ride $10,000 bikes, but that $3,000 bike, there's a difference for sure. But you and I, like, we're not going to hit anything because the bike doesn't have $7,000 more worth of fancy stuff on it, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. What you can do with bikes now is drastically improved. You don't have to worry about, I mean, there was a certain point where you almost had to spend more money just so your bike wouldn't fall apart. And we're way past that now, which is nice. You can buy these, what we're calling budget bikes. They're still expensive. But yeah, like you said, the $2,500, $3,500 bikes, but you can ride everything. You can go in a bike park. You could ride hard trails and not worry about your crank's falling off, your fork falling, breaking in half. So yeah, we're at a good spot for that as far as durability, I'd say.
While we're being positive, I want to say also that the industry is pretty cool. Like, there's genuinely awesome people who care about the sport in a lot of positions in the industry. Levy's rolling his eyes. He hates everybody, but I don't know. I think there's yeah, there's a lot of really genuine people in the industry, and I'm happy to see them when we run into them at camps. And it's an industry where, because it's so endemic and like enthusiast driven, people who don't have MBAs still rise to higher positions to make generally good decisions, and we benefit from that versus spreadsheet people.
That's true. Kaz, what about you? What are you happy with the industry right now?
Kind of along the same lines. It just has how dialed most bikes have gotten across the board. You know, price aside, just we've always talked about geometry finally getting really good, and I think we're at a pretty good spot with geometry. You know, we'll talk about standards pretty soon, but right now things have kind of settled out for the last couple of years. Like, there haven't been any drastic, seemingly unnecessary changes in the last few years, which is nice. It's kind of at this like neutral spot right now where there's room for improvement, but it's not, I don't think there's need for drastic improvement in any one area, which is, I think it's kind of just reached a good spot where you could kind of start working on refinement rather than radical overhauls. So, you know, your average consumer walks into a shop, whatever they walk out with, more than likely it's going to be a good bike. You know, I'm sure all of you also get asked, you know, which bike should I buy? And a lot of times the answer is it doesn't really matter. You know, there's obviously bikes for personal preferences, but you're not going to get a bike like, oh, they sold me a lemon. I mean, at least not in most cases. There are examples of, you know, bikes that aren't great, but overall, I'd say the vast majority of mainstream bikes are at a really good place.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm going to go with something a bit less tangible. My pick is that there's mountain biking everywhere. Like, this isn't really an industry thing. It's more of a sport thing. But like, I remember, I mean, I grew up in a town of 70, 80,000 people. And I remember 25 years ago, there being like 3 mountain bikers in the town. And now we have Trail Forks, and I'm driving down the highway on a road trip somewhere, and I pull up Trail Forks as I pass by a town that has 50 people in it. And it's got a ton of kick-ass mountain bike trails. Like, it just seems like mountain biking is everywhere, and you could do it almost everywhere, you know? And that's kind of my pick. It's such a neat sport. You could do it everywhere. Lots of people loving it. So,
yeah, I think it's good. Like, the sport has grown, obviously, because of, you know, COVID. There's like a little boom, and now we're maybe into a little bit of a bust. But I think the cool thing is that the sport's not going anywhere. Like, I got sucked into some rabbit hole the other day watching a video about what happened to rollerblading. Like, how come rollerblading died? And I think the good thing is mountain biking is not rollerblading. Like, it's been around for, you know, decades now, and it's not going anywhere. And we're getting, you know, new people in the sport, especially like the younger generation. They're just insanely talented, better than any of us ever will be.
And it's really
cool to see that. Like, it's very annoying, but also like, it's humbling and good too. So it's like the future of the sport's looking bright too. So I think that's good. You know, not really industry related, but just like the sport in general it's going to do well.
This is all way too positive, folks.
I know, right?
I know, we'll get yeah.
So, for everybody listening, make sure to tell us in the comments. Like, I'm sure you're going to tell us what the industry doesn't do well, but also tell us what you like about the industry. What is the mountain bike industry doing well right now? And since Brian is here, Kaz, we're going to cover news today, and we're going to start off with Matt Beer's review of this Prime Thunderflash, which might be one of the best looking bikes I've seen in a long, long time. Tell me about it, Kaz.
Yeah, definitely. It's a Polish company, Primes. They make just a couple bikes, this enduro bike and then a downhill bike, which I actually think we have that in for review at some point too. This one's got a dual length suspension layout, 165 millimeters of travel. And Matt really liked the all round nature of it. Like, it, you know, it looks like a big burly bike, and it is, but you can also ride it as a little bit more of an all rounder. He was impressed with the suspension performance. He did end up putting a -1 angle set on there just to kind of see what that would do. But overall, yeah, he really liked it, especially for a company that none of us had spent any time with their products before. So yeah, pretty impressive debut from them.
Have you guys heard of this company before? And question for you, would you buy a bike from a small company on the other side of the ocean? Or would you prefer to buy something that's easier to deal with if there are any issues, easier to deal with the company maybe?
Well, Two questions. One, did it come out before the We Are One Arrival? Because it's very Arrival-esque in some of its lines.
That's why I like it.
I think it might have. It was one of those companies where they launched and then it took them a little bit to actually get the bikes to market. So I'm not exactly sure the timing on that. And it took us a while to get this in. Again, just there have been so many delays and things. But
Okay.
I don't know. I might be wrong, but I feel like they were either, I don't know. I don't actually know, but I feel like it was before. But
The internet says that it was released before The Arrival. I don't know if that's true, but
yeah.
Anyways, is there any, yeah, it looks great. And I don't know. People have taken bigger risks on other bikes. Lots. Just think of the first people to buy anything, like.
Yeah. So you would then. If you liked it, it doesn't matter where it comes from.
I would.
Yeah.
Again, if you don't have a bike stand in your garage, maybe not. I don't know. Or yeah. If you don't have another bike, maybe not.
But. Fair enough. Yeah. Cass, tell us about Matt's pink bike poll about full face helmets.
Yeah, so the poll this week was, why don't we wear a full face helmet more often? Matt posed the question just saying, you know, plenty of us are riding in sketchy terrain and half shell helmets, and he wanted to know the reasons that people aren't choosing full face helmets, especially since there's a lot more lighter weight, better ventilated options than ever. Ended up being 15,000 responses to the poll, nearly 500 comments. So there's about 2,300 people said they always wear a full face. 5,600 said they're too hot. 5,600 said the trails they ride don't usually call for a full face, and 2,000 said they just don't want to. Yeah, I don't know. Like, personally, I don't wear one that often, and I don't want to say that I should, because like, talking about personal protective apparel choices is like one of those things. Like, I'm not going to tell anyone what to do. Like, if somebody wants to dress up like a stormtrooper, that's fine. And if someone wants to do nothing, like, I mean, wear a helmet, but that's really the only thing that I care about. So I don't know. What about you, Levy?
Yeah, I would agree with you. This reminds me, when we did the field test in Quebec, there was this really, really rocky section of trail that we shot on a bunch. And it looked pretty gnarly. I mean, the camera guys are pretty good at making stuff look gnarlier than it is, to be honest. But I was riding in just like, you know, XC lightweight shorts and a jersey, and it was slippery, and it looked pretty sketchy in the photos. And a whole bunch of people were like, basically, like, what the hell are you doing? You need to wear knee pads. Like, stop being a bad example, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, what are you, like, the knee pad police? Like, yeah. I don't think anybody should tell anybody what to wear, first off. For me, personally, I rarely wear a full face. Even, like, Kaz, you see me in the Whistler Bike Park? I wear a beanie in the Whistler Bike Park all the time.
Yeah,
I
love that's it. Stupid. You're an idiot.
Yeah.
But when speeds reach a certain point, I do like to wear a full face.
Yeah.
And you go slow. Yeah, but
you're going, that is true. Kaz, you're going just as fast on some of your local trails where you're wearing a beanie as you are in the bike park. A full face feels like super claustrophobic to me, and like closed in and antisocial. It feels antisocial, guys.
Levy, the most social person we know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Brian, what do you think?
I don't feel that much more safe in some of the lighter full faces. So for me, like, I have a lighter full face, and it's one of the heavier ones. And I like that one, but it's one of the heavier ones. It's like a bigger, burlier full face. And I'm like, so just like the threshold where I switch over to that is a little further. I think maybe I am just scarred from being, you know, 14 or 15 years old and having a Giro switchblade and crashing and it doing absolutely nothing, other than one time I crashed in a gravel pit and I just remember sliding and it was just shoveling dirt and sand into my mouth. That's all it was there for.
Do you guys remember the helmet company called, it starts with a Q, it's called Crank?
No.
Yeah, so
did it have a lot of vents in it?
Yeah, it had a bunch of vents. This was around the time Chris Kovarik was racing on an Intense and doing pretty well, and Michael Ronning had one too. Anyways, Chris Kovarik was wearing one, so I got one. It was my first full face. It was a bright yellow Crank, and I don't know, it made me feel really cool, but let me put it this way. Nowadays, I don't need an excuse to not do anything. Like, it's never like, oh, I'm not going to hit that because I don't have a full face. Like, I'm just not going to do it. So I don't know. Maybe I just don't need a full face anymore.
Yeah. I'd go either way. If people want to wear them, that's great. And if they don't, I'm not going to shame them for wearing the wrong thing. You know, like, be careful. Be smart.
Exactly. This week's Pink Bike Podcast is presented by Intense Cycles. Intense is proud to celebrate its 30th anniversary this year. And since day one, Intense has used racing as its process for bike innovation, which shows through in the new Tracer 29 and 279 Enduro models. The Intense Tracer comes in two wheel size options with 170 millimeters of rear wheel travel and an in-tube storage system. Check out the new Tracer and the rest of the Intense Cycles lineup at www.intensecycles.com. Now back to the show. Kaz, there was also some big news in the drivetrain world with Shimano debuting their Q's system. Can you tell us all about that?
Yeah. Q's, it's actually some really interesting, fairly affordable drivetrain components. It's just the way that it rolled out is kind of confusing. It seems it sits in its own different world and all the words and numbers and things get kind of jumbled together. Even the name Q's stands for creating unique experiences. So, it's kind of, yeah. Yeah. It's
I didn't strange. Know that.
I like the idea, but I hate the abbreviation, the acronym. Like, come
yeah,
on.
Yeah, exactly. But essentially, this should be the replacement to Shimano's like Acera Alivio Grupo. It's kind of like their really more budget tiered stuff. And it's designed to be super long lasting, really reliable, with good range. And uses their Link Glide technology. And that's, again, that's kind of aimed at being super reliable. So ideally, you could buy this stuff for not that much money, run it for multiple seasons and not need to replace anything, which all good things.
We did a little Q&A with Nick Murdoch from Shimano last week on Link Glide specifically as a tech. So I think that'll come out next week, Levy?
Yeah, okay. Next week. So Link Glide has been out for a little while now. Link Glide is the tech that they've employed in the Q's drivetrain. And basically the idea there is much longer lasting drivetrain. Shimano says the cassette's CAS lasts 300% as long. So from 1 year to 4 years, I would have said 1 year to 3 years, but Brian already did the math for me. and it uses the same chain across the board. It uses a slightly different cable pull ratio that Shimano says works better with the system. So it's this Q's stuff isn't compatible with non-Q's drivetrain, but they say there's good reason for that. And we get into all the tech details in that podcast. So,
yeah, the quick hit on that cable pull is that it's linear. So you can go from 9-speed, 10-speed, 11-speed by just adding a different shifter or a different cassette. And it makes the upgrade paths through the whole system a lot better. So I'm hoping to see a lot more value bikes in that, you know, $1,500 to $3,500 range come with this stuff soon.
And Shimano was already kicking ass in the sort of entry to mid-level range stuff, if you ask me. Like, it was already shifting really, really well. But this stuff just brings that kind of great shifting to a lower performance and also hopefully better durability. That's the big thing for me. So we'll see. Yeah. Kaz, let's finish this off with a downhill bike review. Exciting times. Yeah. Downhill bikes on Pink Bike.
Yeah, exactly. Matt Beer's been crushing it lately. He's our resident downhill wizard. And this one was the Orange. And it looks a lot like oranges of the past. And so obviously all the normal comments came up. The looks tend to be polarizing. But Matt liked the bike. He did say it was a little bit noisy. Or he said there was resonance from the frame. Just it's kind of like that frame shape kind of giving him a little more feedback. The chainstays are longer than the reach, which is pretty interesting. It just makes for different ride experience. I mean, it's designed to go downhill fast and be stable, and that should definitely do it. And that's exactly what he found out. You know, it just says that it's when it's really fast and gnarly, it just wants to stay on its line and holds it well.
That one of the pros is listed as geometry negates the need to go around objects. I love it.
Yeah. I mean, it's something for some downhill bikes. That's what you want. You just want a bike that feels like you can just plow through anything. So it's.
He said, Kaz, he said it had a bit of Grim Donut in it.
Yeah. I mean, it is like long and slack and different. It's like different and the same because we've been seeing Orange come out with the same look for a long time, but they've definitely been pushing things as far as geometry goes. So. I like that they're still around and still sticking, you know, holding to their guns and very distinctive looking bike. And I've got a soft spot for them too.
Yeah. You know why, Kaz? That's because we've been around for a while. So we remember Orange from back in the day when they were like super, well, I mean, they're still exotic, but like especially back then, they were super, super exotic. So I like them just because sometimes people don't. And also people kind of, they make jokes about the gate, you know, farm gate.
Yeah.
Those guys at Orange, we've talked to them a bunch of trade shows. They're great. They like, they don't take offense to it. They think it's funny and they do make great bikes. So yeah.
Yep. Yeah. This one, I mean, back to the chainstay on it, 465 chainstay for all sizes is definitely pretty interesting. Like if you're on a size small, then your reach should be 443 millimeters with a 465 chainstay. I wonder how that rides. I don't know if I've ridden, I think I've only ridden one or two bikes that has the chainstay length longer than the reach. I'd like to try again, or even an even one. I know, like, I've seen people think that that's the magic number, which I don't believe it is. But like, if you had a, you know, 480 mil reach bike with a 480 chainstay, I don't think it's magic, but I do want to try it.
Yeah. Every time I ride a bike that has a long rear end, like a 450 rear end, I'm like, oh, I like this. So
fun fact, the original Grim Donut geometry concept that I did for the first one was going to be 500 mil reach, 500 mil chainstay, 90 degree C tube angle, and 45 degree head tube angle. Just make everything perfectly balanced.
Oh yeah, now I remember.
That would have made for some great ad copy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, back in 2014, I reviewed a Diamondback Mission 27.5, and so that one, just looking at the numbers here, the Diamondback Mission had a 416 mil reach and 451 chainstays.
Oh, nice. Was that the red one in Sedona, Cass? Nice. I remember that.
It's kind of orangey. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the shock blue, but I forget.
Yeah. Who knows? But yeah, it would be fun to, maybe I'll have to borrow the Grim Donut and do some experimenting. But
yeah.
Either way. Yeah. Well, that wraps up the news for the week. Let's move on to what the industry can do better.
Yeah. Let's move on to being negative, my specialty. Let's, let's start with Seb's article. He has five things in there, and I just want to go through them and ask you guys if you agree before we get to our own ideas. So the first one he has is suspension setup guides. He says Norco does an absolutely great job of giving recommended pressures and damper settings and stuff, which they do. Norco absolutely kills it, but he says that most other brands suck at this. What do you guys think?
Yeah, agree.
Yeah, it's a good point. There are a few companies that have their suspension guides are good. I would say not any or not too many are as good as Norco's, but yeah, I mean, if you're spending $5,000, $10,000 on a bike and then you go to the website and there's nothing about how to set it up, it seems kind of crazy. It doesn't matter what level you're at. It's nice to have base settings. So I will say Santa Cruz has really good detailed base settings. They're not, you know, not all companies have the nice, like, fancy enter your height, weight, and all that and come out with good numbers, like little widgets on their websites, but at least even a chart that just shows what you should do. It's like, yeah, Santa Cruz is good. I think Breck is pretty good too.
You know who I want to say is pretty good? Specialized. Because some of their bikes have a crazy amount of geo adjustments and they have that little micro site you can go to, little pop-up window, and you could do it. You can like choose your riding style, like if you want your bike to be, you know, whatever, or if you want to go the other direction, you can go that way. So it gives you suggestions. So if you're, or you can be more precise, like if you just have a general idea and you don't know your exact things, it tells you where to put them. But you could also get way more precise with it, which is super neat. Brian, does this come down to suspension companies or bike companies? And tell me why.
It comes down to bike companies and just limited resources. Like, everybody can dyno shocks, and they should be as they're doing their speccing. If here, Raw, the small Swiss company Raw, does really good. It's kind of a different, they don't use any fancy enter your stuff in here type tech, but they've got really good breakdowns, like down to the shock they recommend for the bike and for the riding style and everything. I guess some of the bigger brands will struggle with this because if you're speccing one model from $2,500 in an aluminum version up to $15,000 or something, you're going to have six different shocks to give recommendations for, and good brands are doing custom tunes for smaller sizes with lighter riders and different tunes for heavier riders. So it does get complicated for, I think, those mid-sized brands that just don't have the resources to, they have the resources to do the right thing on the product. They don't necessarily have the resources to tell you about it.
Yeah, yeah. I also want to shout out Cane Creek. I think they still have that app, Kaz, but when their double barrel came out, I remember it had a ton of adjustments. So they came out with an app that had all the bikes on it, and you could select your bike and your weight and riding style and all this stuff. So that was the suspension company doing it from their end, which I thought was pretty good. Yeah, I mean, one other thing I would like to see, speaking of suspension, are sag markers on sanction tubes and shock shafts and stuff. And I think that's a patented, there's a patented thing that we can't, companies, other companies can't use them. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, RockShox has the patent for it on their, on stanchions, but would you really want it on fork stanchions? I don't think you need that for a fork.
I don't, no, personally, I don't think I need it, but I think that the general consumer, like, it wouldn't be a bad thing, but I think it's more important on shocks. But then you get into stroke lengths and shaft lengths, and they'd have to put the markings on the shafts for specific bike yeah. models. It's super complicated. So that's one of the reasons that they don't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess we kind of were nice to come, because I mean, I would say that better suspension setup guides would be good, but on the whole, it's been nice to see more and more companies doing it. But while we're talking about internet and websites and things, that's, we've mentioned it before, but so many bike companies' websites are horrible to navigate. Like if you're just shopping for a bike and you go to, off the top of my, who's really bad right now, but I mean, sometimes Yeti's, I haven't looked at Yeti's website in the last few weeks, but in the past you go there and there's all these like scroll down pages and it's like, I just want to know the bike, the price and the geometry. And so I think that there is room for like improved user experience in mountain bike websites. Just make it simple and then you can have all your fluffy stuff on another section.
The one that kills me is when the brands show you the bike at model instead of the platform. Like, I don't, maybe this is just, I'm shopping for bikes differently than the consumer. And Specialized probably has better data on this than me, but it drives me nuts that I have to go down to the model to see geometry info and stuff. Like, to me, I figure, or like platform info about how much travel the platform's designed for, what it's intended for. Like, to me, I figure out what bike I want, and then I figure out how much I'm willing to spend on it. Like, which of the derailleurs hanging off the back is the one that's right for me. But like, my decision is on a platform, not on the specific model. And yeah, like if you go to Specialized website, it's just a barrage of 100 different models, and you're just like, no, I just want to see the information on the stump jumper, and then I'll figure out what derailleur I want on it.
So, since we're talking about Specialized, I think it is the Specialized website. I have had a hard time finding out how much travel some bikes have. Yeah. Like, if you go there, they don't just say it. Like, you have to go to the spec sheet and look at the frame on the spec sheet, which seems kind of strange. But anyways, let's move on. Seb's next thing was stem spacers. He wants to see bikes come with way more stem spacers. Now, I'm going to frame this a little bit just so people know Seb. Seb is 7'4". So he rides a triple quad extra large bikes, and his stems are never tall enough. His handlebars are never tall enough. But he would like to see more stem spacers stock. Brian?
Well, it was kind of, I know his next point was make more proportionate sizing, which again makes sense for a 100-foot tall person, but are they kind of the same? Like, theoretically, my take is that proportionate sizing, maybe he was talking about the back ends, but for me, if you look at head tube lengths, they don't grow proportionately to a lot of the other things on a bike, because you can always run more stem spacers to get higher up in the front. Sure, you lose a bit of reach, but that's why, like, they want to give tall people the option of getting lower in the front. But to me, it always ends up a bit goofy, and you get shortened reach, which is not what you want as a tall person. So then you have a low stack and you just have to run super tall 80 mil rise bars or something. And to me, I think he's right. We should see more proportionate sizing, including the head tube, but then we don't need as many stem spacers.
Yeah, if you made taller head tubes, you wouldn't have to have this crazy stack of spacers under it. And aesthetically, I don't really, the look of lots of spacers always looks strange to me. And I know really tall riders that end up on bikes. Like, I ride with a guy and he's tall enough that he can run an uncut fork in his bike. And that's the right size. Yeah, it looks very crazy. Yeah. He's got, I think it's like a Santa Cruz Heckler or something, but it's just, you can just stick it in, put the spacers under it, and he's good. It's like, it's pretty wild.
You know,
is this Chris Mandel?
Yeah.
on the other hand, though, how many double extra large frames are they selling versus medium and large frames? But I guess if they're going to make a different frame, they can make the
nothing.
Head tube
it costs
longer.
Geometry costs nothing. Yeah. I say it till I'm blue in the face. But it doesn't cost anything to make the sizing on the front triangle proportionate. The rear triangle, I understand why brands are trying to get more out of a single mold for the back end, but just for cost reasons. But that also kind of drives me nuts. And especially if you're orange on that downhill bike, like what? I don't understand the reason if you have a boutique made in Britain, like, if you're paying for being closer to the manufacturing, why can't the manufacturing be a little more nimble and make a longer back end for the bigger sizes? I don't get it.
Yeah, fair enough.
Like, if you have longer levers acting on the bike, why wouldn't you want the stability to grow proportionately?
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm always curious, like, yeah, there's lots of theories about what is best in the proportion, but it's interesting because you will have companies come out and say, oh, we're doing proportionate sizing now. And then there's like 3 mil chainstay difference. And I don't think that people can notice that, you know, like they're like, look, we did it. And like, did you, like, was that worth the effort to do it? You know, it's like, I feel like you either have to make it, at least do some experimentation to figure out what proportions actually feel different, or just don't do it at all. So, yeah,
I'd like to get
more experimentation in that.
I'd like to get somebody from, is his name Luis from Cannondale, who does all of the kinematics per size, like different suspension kinematics per size, because that takes what we're talking about to a whole new level. And I'd be really curious to figure out how they do that.
A lot of work, yeah. A lot of spreadsheets, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Calculators. Yeah. Yeah. Let's move on. Seb's next thing. Clean up unnecessary standards. I think the mountain bike industry is pretty good with this, to be honest with you. I think I just made a lot of people mad, but I would like to see seat posts be the same size. What about you?
Yeah, I'm good with seat posts. Could be all the same size. I don't like center lock brakes, so if center lock went away, that'd be fine. Yeah. I know there's center lock. There's super fans out there, but I just get annoyed when a wheel set comes in that's center lock. I'm like, I just have like 1,000. It's probably just because I have 1,000 6-bolt rotors and like only a few center lock. That's just a me issue, but I don't know. I just like 6-bolt. And even if someone says center lock's better, I like 6-bolt. So it's.
Because center lock rocks back and forth too. It's not acceptable.
Yeah. It's just more of a pain. And you have to, I don't know.
That's a different podcast though.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'd be fine if that went away. Yeah. Obviously. And Seb mentioned the free hub standards, which it would be cool if there was just one, but that's not going to happen because of the competing drivetrain companies. Even though we were talking about Qs. So Qs uses Shimano's HG free hub body, and Shimano makes the micro spline for their higher end stuff. And it's kind of too bad they haven't just gone all in on one free hub design. Cause that way, if you're a entry level consumer and you've got this component group and you want to go with something fancy, now you still have to buy a whole nother free hub body to go with your fancy new drivetrain. So
I could be totally wrong, but I think micro spline requires being made out of aluminum and rather than steel. So
it costs more to make.
It would cost more to make. And I think we did convince, we pleaded our case with Nick to make a micro spline version of some of the Link Glide stuff in that podcast when we recorded with him, because again, media problems here, but it would be nice to just have less free hubs kicking around.
Yeah. Link Glide makes a lot of sense for like a free ridey or a downhill bike group, which he sort of admitted they're thinking about, which, if it comes out anytime soon, they were thinking about it years and years ago. But for that to happen, I think the downhill bike group that uses Link Glide would use a micro spline to get that small cog so they can use a slightly smaller chainring. And that's the only way I think we're going to see it for that, personally. Seb's last thing, he wants to see frame bearing swaps easier and make it easier to get frame bearings.
I mean, I'm spoiled. I haven't had too many problems swapping bearings. I don't typically have to swap too many bearings, but like, I'd be curious to know what his
ideal. Because you're on a new bike every 2 weeks, Kaz.
No, I mean, I know, like, that it is rare, but I'd be curious to know what his, like, what his ideal bike configuration would be. Like how are the bearings fixed in there? I mean, it is nice when there's like a little seat on the backside of the, like, where the bearing is mounted to, where you can knock it out easily.
Yeah.
Like, just trying to think of what the ideal scenario would be like. Santa Cruz is pretty easy because you can just pull out the whole little linkage and knock them out.
There are definitely some brands that are better than others at their hardware and like blind pivots and how to get stuff out. And yeah.
For me, the bearings have to be in the aluminum and not the carbon. That's like, put the bearings in the aluminum links or in aluminum inserts in the frame. Just don't push them into carbon. I think that's the best answer for consumers and the world, personally.
Levy wants cup and cone everywhere, people.
No, you see, it was at Santa Cruz, Kaz, that just moved that way. They put all their bearings in the links now. So have to like be farting around. Yeti, yeah. You don't have to be farting around with your bearing press, or some people use a vise to push out bearings, and you're like, you're trying to angle the swing arm and you got your stupid two sockets because you don't have the right tools. And like, but if it's just in the link, that's just a lot easier to manage. So I don't think it's like a world changing problem, but it'd be nice to see.
Yeah.
Should we talk about stuff that we think could be better now?
Sure.
Yeah. Brian, kick it off.
Oh man. Okay. I'm going to start with an easy one. There's too many damn initialisms. Talking about cues. Like, we need as an industry to just have a little moratorium. Not everything needs to be FSR, VPP, Qs, like 3- and 4-letter acronyms and initialisms. Let's just stop.
Don't, like, when they come up with something, I'm just going to play devil's advocate here. When they come up with something, they have to have a way to share that message to consumers. So for them, they're like, well, how we need to call it something to say we have something so people can buy this thing or people want to buy this thing. So how do you tell people the story then?
I mean, there's lots of words to describe things that aren't initials of things.
No, I just, and like, just make up your own.
I mean, like, naming things is really hard. That's fair. And it's much more difficult to trademark the initialisms. So you can... That's why there are XTR truck subgroups and XTR suspension thing. Or sorry, it's XTR is a drivetrain thing. But we've got enough initialisms. Let's just pause. Let's call things something else. We'll call it like, I don't know, like water or dice or...
If you don't espresso, like initials, can we have acronyms now instead? Just only acronyms, but no initials.
No. No acronyms, no initialisms. No. Hey, Link Glide. Link Glide is a great technology name. If they'd called it like LG2X23, you'd just be like, oh God.
Yeah, I agree.
It hasn't ever bothered me, but I think it's funny because then we get to like make fun of things when they have funny acronyms and initialisms. But
yeah,
I don't know. But
I think what bugs me is that there are so many unnecessary technologies on bikes, or like fake technologies that aren't a real technology. Like this geometry is a technology. No, it's just your geometry, people. Yeah, you know what I mean.
Well, that's actually one of my on my list is just fewer gimmicks. I feel like companies, because bikes have gotten so good, they want to roll something out and they try to chase like gimmickry, whether that's in my mind, something like even like Flight Attendant or Tire Whiz or the little thing that remotely tells you the pressure in your shock, like the shock, like the integrated Shock Whiz. A lot of these things, those are all SRAM things, but there's other companies doing, they probably have some benefits, but they also seem so gimmicky that it's just like you're chasing problems that don't exist. You know, they just kind of annoy me when you're like, I don't need this stuff. I want bikes are simple. And that's what I like about them is overall, they're fairly simple. So when you just start sticking bells and whistles and stuff on there, I don't know. It's almost like companies have we'll bring in an acronym. Companies have FOMO. They're afraid of being left behind if someone comes out with something they don't have. So it's just a constant like game of catch up. So that's kind of what we saw when e-bikes first launched. Everyone's like, oh, we need an e-bike. And then they rolled out a bunch of kind of subpar e-bikes until they actually had time to figure things out. So I think that that whole like rush to not be last can definitely, it doesn't always work. I'd like a little bit more like time taken to think about what you're rolling out.
Kaz, the things you mentioned there, they're all battery powered. Mm-hmm. I think you're letting your hate for battery powered accessories color your opinions.
No, I don't mind like access stuff. It's fine. Yeah. I've come to terms with the, I don't forget to charge my battery very often. And like, I don't mind that. If there are benefits, you know, but like certain, mm-hmm. just like sticking little, even like integrated lights and things. I don't know. Sometimes some of this stuff is just not necessary, you know, like I get it, but it's also like, it feels like there's a guy or girl trying to like save, not save their job, but like, be like, I'm working on this. This is my project this year. I'm going to integrate all this stuff into this. And like, did you have to do that? Could you have worked on maybe like making sure that the chain slap noise is real quiet or that the head angle is better? I don't know.
I mean, Kes, that is exactly what is happening though. Like someone is sitting somewhere and they need to make the bike look exciting and look super interesting. And they need to write 3 paragraphs about the new acronym.
It is very, very rarely the engineer that gets tasked with doing the thing that is the one pushing for that thing. It is
and definitely it's not the engineer.
And it's not the marketing department either, to be honest. It's often the trade side of it. It's a distributor or a bike shop that is like super annoyed that the shop across the road has Specialized, and Specialized just came out with this, all the SWAT boxes. And it's like, oh my God, we need something to compete with it. Like, why don't you have more technologies? And they're getting yelled at. That is driving. So it's like, it's sales, perceived sales need that is driving a lot of those requests for what we see as gimmicky things. I'll say, Kaz, I agreed with many of the things you said. To me, flight attendant doesn't quite fit in the same thing. I think that there's a lot of potential for going down that road. It may not be a perfect system. It may not be for you, but I think that's maybe fundamentally different than the thing that tells you what pressure your tires are at. You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, and like even talking about tires, like remember Plus tires? I think one thing that bothers me in the industry is when the industry gets, they just hop on something so hard and they're like, this is the best. And then they really, to use the term that commenters like to use, they try to shove it down everyone's throats. And you're like, I don't know if this is it. Like, it's like, it always just bothers me a little bit when you see these trends hop on that you're skeptical about, but then everybody tries to tell you that it's the next amazing thing. And you're like, I don't know. So luckily we don't really, at the moment, I don't see one. Like, we're kind of in a good spot, but I feel like something will pop up soon that'll be like, oh, the 32-inch wheels that you want, Brian, are going to be the next example.
No, what I want is, I'm just with Seb. It's the proportional sizing. He is 700 feet tall. He should not be riding the same wheels as me.
I mean, his car probably has the same size wheels as yours.
It's different.
Yeah.
And it probably does it, actually. Yeah, probably, yeah,
sure. There's a lot of sizes there, too. I know. And I couldn't think of one off the top of my head.
Okay, I'm gonna call us out and just media in general a little bit here. I think that Pink Bike Cycling Tips and a lot of other media out there need to do a better job of reviewing middle of the price range bikes. So we ride lots of $7,000 bikes to $10,000, sometimes even an $11,000 bike. And I think that we do a decent job of riding so-called value bikes every year, that we try to keep them, you know, under $3,000. We've had $1,000 hardtails, and we do that a couple times a year. We do like a group test thing. So, but I'd like to see us and everybody else reviewing more of the $4,000, $5,000, and $6,000 bikes out there. Mm-hmm. Maybe not $6,000, but I see, like, you go to the trailhead. There's a lot of expensive bikes here in the Sea to Sky, but you go to the trailhead and I see countless like $4,000, $5,000, like commensals and things like that, that like they make a lot of sense. So I think we could do a better job of reviewing those types of bikes.
Levy, the people's champion. We'll see what's your next review coming out.
It's a $10,000 carbon gravel bike.
I mean, again, my secret communism is showing here. For me, the high end is, it really bothers me when I look at a bike and I can see that the spec was done to get the bike up to a price point rather than down to a price point.
How, what, can you explain that? How do you mean? Shouldn't they be coming in? Like, doesn't a company want to sell the most bike they can for the least amount of money?
Good brands, yes, and sort of consumer rider-focused brands, yes. But there are definitely brands and times where, like, and I don't want to necessarily fault individual product managers and brands for doing it, because you're trying to, like, if there's a clear market asking for $10,000, $15,000 bikes, then you're kind of an idiot to not supply that demand. But there are definitely times where you look at a bike and it's got just so many things that are not even better, but just more expensive. And you go, oof, like that is obnoxiously high end rather than that is high performance. So I don't know. Yeah, for me, I'm not saying everything should be like XT. We should mandate a price cap on everything. XT is the highest you can buy. Like, you know, Axis banned. I'm not saying that, but I do. Oh, we lost Kaz. Kaz was so upset about me saying we should ban.
He hung up.
He was like, no, I want my $20,000 bikes. Yeah, I do think that the high end is too high. And I think that's one of the things that is driving consumer skepticism or frustration with, like, when people say that bikes are too expensive, what they mean is that they want to buy the nicest bike in existence and they can no longer afford it. Even though the bike they can afford is better than it used to be, it pisses them off that the nicest thing in the world is no longer available to them.
Yeah, I agree. And the flip side to that too is, how many Toyota Camry reviews are you reading? Hey?
You only read Toyota Camry reviews when you're looking to buy a sensible car. And then you stop. And so us media are definitely guilty of writing things that people are interested in. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. Like, I mean, the Valkyrie reviews, video reviews came out yesterday.
I know.
And dude, like, I was just like, okay, I'm good for 2 hours. Nobody bothered me for 2 hours. Levy, I'm not buying a Valkyrie.
We're straying obviously dangerously close to F1 territory here.
It's a car, but I'm not going to buy one, but I still want to, I still want to hear all about it. Every tiny little detail. And I feel like there's a lot of people that feel the same way about the next $10,000 superbike. Kaz, thanks for joining us again. You seem like a pretty reasonable guy, but I imagine you like to read about all sorts of things that you can't afford. Am I correct?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah, like the comments about we should only review cheap bikes don't really do much to me. Like, I agree that we should definitely try to get in some more value-priced or mid-range bikes, but I also don't feel any guilt reviewing these high-end things, because if I was on the other side, I always like reading about the unattainable, like, crazy new things that come out. And a lot of times that is where the new technology ends up on these highest-end bikes first and then trickles down. So it's a way to see what the future of value bikes could be in a way.
Yeah, yeah. The one thing that's is difficult sometimes it's easier to relate that like $8,000 bike to the $5,000 bike, but sometimes the really expensive bikes have like crazy, way more adjustable, fancy suspension on them, and then it's like it has a lot less to do with that, like the $4,000 version of that bike, you know, when it has completely different suspension. So Brian, what else do you think the industry could do better?
Okay, well, my first one was a bit of a joke. This is one I feel very, very, very strongly about. I think that our industry has way too much reliance on credit. I think I've said it at some point offhand before, but what I mean by that is that a typical bike sale, the rider takes money on their credit card or through or their bank or shop financing to buy a bike. That shop borrowed money from the distributor to bring the bike in on terms, and is trying to sell it before the money's owed. The distributor likely borrowed from the exporting country's government to import the bike, and the brand that made the bike borrowed from the bank and the assembly plant to actually get the bike assembled somewhere in Taiwan. That assembly plant is borrowing from their governments to pay suppliers. and the suppliers are borrowing to acquire raw materials. Like, obviously, financial flexibility has its benefits. Obviously, credit is needed to make this industry work. But there is a lot of money getting funneled away from both consumers and from the industry into bankers' pockets. And I would love to see our industry rely less on credit. We really saw it get quite bad during COVID when everybody's terms got worse and people had to take on a whole bunch of shitty credit. So, and now they are in trouble because of it. So yeah, please, less reliance on credit would be good.
Yeah, I don't understand any of the money things.
Cool. So. You keep working on that one. I'm going to try to make bikes cooler. But
yeah. I get what you're saying, though. That's a good one. Great.
Percentage points at every transaction with more middlemen is not good for anybody.
Yeah, I agree.
I'll start a cashorium. You can only pay cash at my bike shop.
There you go. Okay, here's an easier one. Man, there are ever encroaching walled gardens in sort of super integrated bikes. It concerns me.
The walled garden?
Yeah, the walled gardens of different.
There's a fever dream yet.
I don't understand this one either. Can you explain that?
A walled garden being like a drivetrain system or a suspension system or something that doesn't work with anything else.
Oh, I see.
So integrated. Anytime a bike gets more and more integrated, for example, e-mountain bike motors are and batteries don't have the standards that some other things in our industry do, and it's super frustrating. Like voiding your warranty because you took off your chainring on an e-bike motor is unacceptable to me.
Don't admit that. They're listening. You won't get your warranty.
I read this on the internet.
I could see that too. And as we're seeing these drivetrains, I mean, we just talked about Linksys, and it uses a slightly Linksys. We just talked about Linklide, and it uses the slightly different kind of a flat cable pull ratio. And there's a reason for that. Shimano has their own proprietary stuff, and SRAM has their own proprietary stuff too. But I think that's what has to happen to get more performance out of these things. That's the flip side to that.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily against brands, especially bigger brands that control a large amount of the market share, having their own thing for smaller brands to also take part in or whatever. It's more when systems are designed to be closed off that bothers me. It's hard to give examples because I'm ascribing intent to decisions that maybe I don't understand enough, but it's frustrating when certain bikes won't work with certain things. It doesn't seem like there's any good reason from a performance standpoint.
Yep. Fair enough. Kaz, do you have any more for us?
I think my final one would be, I think the industry, like lately, it seems they're not doing a good job of making mountain bike seem as cool as it is. Like mountain biking is awesome. It's so fun. But then all these ads and videos and things come out and they're all just kind of like sterile, and they just kind of miss the goofing off in the woods with your friends vibe that it's, it kind of like, you know, all of us grew up, we watched a lot of like the old, whether it's Road Fools or the BMX side of things or Drop In or like the kind of like road trip, just like go out with your buddies and do goofy stuff, build sketchy stunts. Like I like that vibe. And I think that's an important part of mountain biking. And like, you just don't see the ad campaigns are so polished and so carefully curated. And you're like, that just seems really sterile and dull. We're like, mountain biking's not like that.
Kaz, your gray hair is showing right now.
Yeah. Right. But no, really, like they're here, even here in Bellingham, there's this crew of goofballs that made a video called Atmospheric River Rats. And if you haven't seen it, you should go watch it. But like, watching that, it came out last year, but watching it, I was like, oh yeah, this is why, like, this is mountain biking to me. It's not so perfect and like, you know, Fabio Wimmer doing the most perfect thing. It's like that rawness, the element of rawness. And I think that companies forget that regular people are riding mountain bikes and that's your core audience, and you should cater to them in some regard.
K- Kaz, you and I are on the same page because my last thing here, I'm going to read it word for word. It says, I'd like to see fewer shreddits and more videos of people trail riding because it's more relatable. And I think my point is very similar to yours. I don't want to see like super polished and so-and-so doing four backflips off like a 20-foot high lip. Like, I want to see something more relatable, and it doesn't have to be polished, and dirt's flying everywhere, and it's got good music and some storytelling to go along with it. Like, I still want that person to get super loose on their trail bike, and we do see videos like that. Who was that one recently? Hugo Fixation or something? The Kumitzel? I'm not pronouncing any of these words right, but you guys know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Hugo Stanction.
Yeah, Hugo Stanction. Good job, Hugo Stanction. You kill it. But I want to see relatable stuff, like people going out on their trail bike and working and having fun and part of a story. But I also want to see them send it, of course. And we do see some of that, but just more, you know, I'd like to see more.
Yeah, I think just like more creativity is what I'm looking for. Part of it's probably just because I've seen an insane number of videos and ad campaigns and all this stuff last 25 years of mountain biking or 30 years. But like, with just starting to seem, gets a little stale. So I do like when things come through that push the boundaries a little bit or something different. Or, I mean, obviously I like when Caleb Polanco does some nutty stuff on the North Shore. Like, I'll watch that all day long. I love that stuff. But yeah, I think just trying to be a little different and out of the box is helpful, because our culture, mountain bike culture, is kind of sterile, and I'd rather it be cooler.
It's kind of, I'd written down that we cling to racing when it doesn't make sense. And I should say, I love racing, big fan, watch everything. But especially when it comes to e-mountain bikes, like, I get it. They're bikes and they've got wheels. We're going to race them. But as a marketing effort, it's just not, I don't like, e-bikes are popular in spite of the hardcores, not because of the hardcores. And they're popular because they're fun and make riding easier. We don't like, are we so devoid of other ideas, marketing ideas, other than racing e-bikes?
Yeah. I mean, that's another market. Like, you know, I don't want to talk about e-bikes, but you could make e-bikes, you could present them in a much better way, show like what you could actually do with them, rather than like, it's just strange. I feel like there's a lot of misguided marketing campaigns. So I don't really want to talk about e-bikes in this podcast, but
yeah.
I'll go back to, like, there was a good video yesterday. It was actually a Shimano video. I feel like we're talking about Shimano too much this podcast.
Lando Steezy.
Lando. That video is so good.
So good.
Yeah. I never heard of that guy. It's rad. Like,
he's awesome.
The music and the thing and like everything was super good. And I like stuff like that. We're like, this guy is just killing it. I never heard of him. I probably should have, but like, I do like finding, because there's so many talented riders right now, more than ever. So, you know, whether it's just kind of like showing more of what's out there rather than this edits from the same people over and over and over again, I think that'd be cool.
Levy, we should get Lando on the podcast. He's super nice.
Yeah, that would be a great podcast. Yeah,
he's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I think we're going to wrap it there. We're definitely not going to talk about e-bikes because I'll just keep talking for the next 3 hours. Let's stop it there. I've got a meeting to go to with Henry, so I need to end. Everybody listening, tell us what you think the industry could do better and post it down in the comments underneath this podcast. But if you're going to do that, I also want you to tell us one thing that the industry does really well right now. Let's keep it positive, a little bit positive anyway. And we'll see you next week. Bye.